This is an insightview.eu podcast. In this podcast interview, InsightView has interviewed immunology professor Jan Pravsgaard Christensen from the University of Copenhagen about what we know and what we do not know about the coronavirus. Jan's research has been concentrated on the immune response to viral infections, effector cell migration to areas of infection, effector molecules in virus control, induction and maintenance of T-cell memory. This is currently being used to develop vaccines against virus and bacteria.
Hi Jan, thank you for spending time with InsightView.eu. In Denmark, the information flow about the coronavirus has been somewhat confusing. It feels like several virus experts know less today than they did in January. Is it how you see the situation as well?
Well, I think it comes with the evolution that happens when you have an epidemic or a pandemic like we have now. Because in the beginning, when you see a new disease emerge and start spreading, you instantly have a lot of knowledge about how have these diseases spread before. We know a lot about how flu behaves on the worldwide scale. We know a lot about coronaviruses and so on. So in the beginning, we have the feeling that we know a lot about what is about to happen. But once we get further in and realize exactly what coronavirus it is and exactly how it behaves, that is where we start sort of missing information, because now we realize it is completely different than the previous SARS. The number of people that are infected, the severity and so on. So that's where we sort of back up a little bit and need to know or get more information. So we are absolutely certain when journalists, for instance, ask us, specifically about this virus, how is it going on? And that's perhaps why you feel in the beginning we know a lot, and later on we realize there are a lot of exemptions that we need to investigate before we can answer uniformly.
It seems that the coronavirus gets new properties every day. How would you characterize the coronavirus compared to SARS?
Well, the original SARS epidemic that we had was very limited, in part because it was much more severe and lethal to people. So it was very easy to contain and find the people that was infected. The problem with the current coronavirus is that it is much more stealthy. It doesn't infect quite as many people per infected person, and you can go on for several days without symptoms where you can infect. So it sort of sneaks into the society, even though you know it is there. We of course know a lot about this virus, but as I said before, once we get into the system and look into it in details, we realize that there are certain exemptions from: do people produce antibodies? Can they be protected? And so on. So that is where the current coronavirus is different than the SARS epidemic.
When it comes to confusion, it applies not least to how the coronavirus infects people. Now, as Europe restarts the economy, we are going back to restaurants, schools and offices. How do we get infected, especially when we are out indoors? In China, studies show that the coronavirus can travel several more meters than the official safe distance.
The discussion about the distance is complicated, because we have some studies that can show how far larger particles and smaller particles can travel. And larger fluid particles, they travel around a meter, and then within that meter, they will drop to the ground. But we know if you are sneezing and coughing and make these microscopic particles, that they, of course, can travel much further. And it's more pronounced when you are indoor compared to outdoor. So in the beginning, it was 2 meters to be on the safe side. Now it is, in some countries, at least 1 meter, because we sort of realized that we can still control the disease with a certain distance, a social distance. The problem when we start opening the society again is that now we have an extra factor, because during the lockdown, we have been sitting at home and primarily infected our families, if that happened. But now, once we get into larger office spaces, cafe, restaurants, and kids get back into school, we have the problem that we are gathering many people in the same place. And the risk of getting infected is a combination both of space between them, but also the time they use together. So, for instance, in large-scale open offices, when many people are sitting together, even if they have a meter of distance, they might still see an increased risk of infection compared to people that you just meet in the street, have a short conversation with, and then leave again. So part of the opening up the society now will be to sort of try to prevent too much gathering in close proximity, but also over longer time. And that's, for instance, why it has been suggested that restaurants and so on, they should only allow people in for a certain time slot and then get them out again so they don't sit in the restaurants for too long.
Okay, and if let's say you have to go from Odense in Denmark to Copenhagen by train. Is there an issue then?
Well, the issue has been there all the time, because it's the same if you go on a plane or a bus. It should probably not be that we pack the trains, buses, planes, and so on completely full, but that we should still keep some distance. So, for instance, only work at 50% capacity, especially in those situations where it's longer travel. There, I would recommend that we think in some sort of distancing to prevent spreading of disease. And the alternative, of course, is in those scenarios that you should use a mask. We haven't had the use of them in Denmark per se, because there are some limitations to them, but they do have some effect, and it can never hurt to, for instance, have masks on when you are sitting in a train for a longer period.
In Denmark, you have to stay home if you feel ill. This raises the question, how large is the share of infected who are thought to be asymptomatic?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because there are two scenarios where you are asymptomatic. In the beginning, when you are infected, you will not have symptoms for several days. And in those days, you still have the virus in your throat. You can still infect other people. It's not quite as likely as if you are severe ill, but after all, you do have the virus and can shed it to the surrounding. So you can infect people without even knowing that you're sick. Then you become severely sick, and then everyone sort of realize, okay, no coughing, sneezing on other people, because now I am infectious. The other part of asymptomatic patient is that they seem not to get any symptoms whatsoever, because we have seen cases where we can see people start developing antibody as a test that they have met the virus. But they have never had any symptoms, presumably because they fought off the disease efficient and fast enough, so symptoms didn't manifest in these people. And they are, of course, a dark horse in all of this, because how many of these people are walking around and unfortunately infect without knowing that their surroundings?
Is it possible to be infected again after being declared recovered? Since January, there has been plenty of examples in Asia. In the same context, do all corona patients create antibodies after having recovered? How long time are they immune, if at all?
And that is several questions in one. We'll take one at a time. But that again go back to the first question you asked, that in the beginning we think we know it all. And as we get into the epidemic, we realize that we don't necessarily know everything about a virus like the corona that we have right now. Had you asked me day one, I would have said that everyone that gets this virus, they become immune, because that is what the textbook in immunology tells us. When you see a microorganism, the immune system learns to deal with it, and the result is that you get immunity, so you are protected later on. But now we have had, as you said, cases where people have been declared recovered, and then they test positive again. And that is one of the scenarios where we are not certain about what is going on, because there are two scenarios how that can happen. There is the scenario you get infected, you recover, and then you get infected the second time. The alternative is that you get infected, you control the infection, but you don't clear it, and you have so little virus left that the testing system don't pick up the virus. And then at a later stage, you will sort of reactivate and the virus starts spreading in the body again. So ideally, it is just one infection that has been there all the time. The testing has just determined you to be negative at a certain stage. And the reason that can occur is that testing in all medical world is not absolute. There are always false positive and false negative when we do these tests. And remember, we are looking for the genetic material from the virus. We take a stick and put it into the throat and scrape a little bit on your lining in the throat. And if there is no virus caught in that procedure, you will be tested negative. But that's not the same to say you didn't have any virus in the lungs and you later can develop the disease or later can develop more virus so you can start spreading it again. So said in another word, if you tested negative and then you coughed intensely and then they took a second scrape, then you will see that this person was actually positive all the time. So that is one of the problems in the testing, and that's why it may appear that some people become infected the second time. Regarding the antibody, again, in the beginning, I would have sworn that everyone made antibody, but that doesn't seem to be the case. There are at least a few people that we know have tested positive based on genetic material where you can't find the antibody, or at least antibody in a very limited number or poor quality. And those people are probably not immune. They will probably behave the second time as if it was the first time they got the virus infection. And that has to do again with if the immune system have fought the virus fast and efficiently enough, that doesn't give the B cell time to produce the antibody, and hence you don't get the immunity. How long do they last? In general, the length of how long antibody persists in people very much depends on the diseases. Because you have example of diseases in the kids' year, measles, mumps, rubella, where you only have to get them once and you are protected for life, because you produce antibody for life. On the other hand, we know from other coronaviruses, some of those viruses that gives us the cold in wintertime, that we tend only to have antibody 2, 3, perhaps 4 years, and then they disappear again. And that means that you are protected for a limited number of years, and then you can be infected essentially with exactly the same virus strain again.
A layman, such as the editor of InsideView, would like to hear what it means to pursue a strategy of herd immunity which is a strategy many health experts recommended in Europe at the early stage of the outbreak. Why have these voices died away as we have learned more about the coronavirus?
Let's start just with what is herd immunity. And herd immunity is based upon if sufficient number are immune because they have seen the disease, the virus has essentially no place to go. And the few that are not immune, the likelihood of two of those meeting, one being infected, is very limited. And that's where an epidemic will die out or not get hold at all. Because you can get herd immunity either by having a disease that travels through the population, or you can get herd immunity if sufficient number of people are vaccinated against the disease. In the beginning, we anticipated that many people would become infected, and then all knowledge tells us when sufficient numbers are infected and immune, then we will get herd immunity and that will prevent the disease from spreading. But as it turned out, it was not as many people that became infected. At present, we estimate that it's probably no more than 5% in Denmark that has or are infected with the virus. And 5% immune people walking around in society have limited to no effect in terms of herd immunity. You have to have a much higher numbers there. So in the beginning, we perhaps anticipated we would end up with some sort of herd immunity that could be a mean of controlling the disease. But that has turned out later on that that is not the case. Also in part, because many countries were very efficient in closing down their communities and in that way also limited the spread and thus the number of immune people that they acquired in the society. So one of the problems with herd immunity when we have a disease rather than a vaccine is of course also if you just allow the disease to spread in the population, susceptible and vulnerable people will also get the disease. And in this case, that means intensive care unit and at worst case, death of some people. So part of the reason perhaps also why you backed away from making herd immunity is also that you will deliberately sacrifice people in this scenario. So people will die so the rest can become immune. And that cannot be the purpose of a health system in at least our society. That's not how we go about it. The goal is to prevent as many as possible to become severely ill. And there are also with coronavirus this extra feature that many of those people that have been in intensive care unit, first of all, they were there longer than we anticipated. Some lies there for 3 or 4 weeks before they get out of intensive unit. Many of those people, they also have long-term effects that they suffer because a lot of damage have happened to their lungs. Many of these people will eventually recover, but it takes months where they are not active, they can't work and so on. And there will probably also be a small proportion of these people that will have more or less lifelong limited effect of their lungs due to all the damage that the virus and the immune system makes when it is combating the virus.
Is it correct to assume that a target of 60% herd immunity will take many years if we do not want to exceed the full capacity level in the healthcare sector? What are the risks associated with a herd immunity strategy? Is herd immunity like raising the white flag?
To take the last first, no, herd immunity is not raising the white flag because herd immunity, you could say, is the positive event that will happen had we not been capable of controlling the disease. So eventually, sufficient number will be immune, so the epidemic dies out. It is right that in case of coronavirus, you need to have somewhere around 60 or 70% herd immunity. And the value depends on how infectious the disease is. Because with flu infection, 60% is for sure enough. With measles, for instance, you need to have at least 95% before herd immunity is of value. But with corona, we can see that 60 to 70%, that would be sufficient for the epidemic to die out. The problem is, as we've already talked about, right now we have perhaps 5% of the population in Denmark that has or are infected. So in order to reach 60%, that will take a very long time. And with the long time, if it is right in terms of antibodies that we have seen with other coronavirus, then at the end, when the last numbers get in to reach the 60%, the very first people that was infected may not be immune anymore. And that will just bring the period even longer before we can even hope at some point that sufficient numbers are immune in the society. And the risk, of course, is also, as I said, if you can't keep the vulnerable people out of society and prevent them from getting the disease, and it's not just people sitting in an elderly home, it's also people that have all sorts of chronic diseases, some of these people inevitably will be infected and potentially also die. So that is a large risk to run for a society, let alone that you have so many people that you need to treat in intensive care unit that your hospital can't keep up. And when the hospital can't keep up, you have to remember that it's not just keeping up with coronaviruses. Now many other functions in the hospital, life-threatening functions, cannot necessarily be maintained when we get to that point.
Is Sweden aiming for herd immunity?
They claim that they are heading for herd immunity. And they claim in the Stockholm area that they will reach a sufficient number of immune here in June, July. I must admit, I have my doubts about it. Because if you compare Denmark and Sweden, we have set up different strategies in terms of lockdown and distancing and so on. And it's not because Sweden have ended up in Italian or UK condition with thousands of infected and dead people. And that sort of tells me that it must be a limited number of people after all that has been infected and thus immune. And that's where I am worried that they may get at 30%, but 30% is not enough to actually have an impact in terms of herd immunity.
What kind of strategy will we have to pursue if herd immunity is not an option? But we also need to restart the economy. Should we shut down the economy again if the number of infected is to increase too quickly? Is such an decision political possible?
We have several options when herd immunity cannot be ruled in. Because the way that we have done it with now in the beginning a complete lockdown, and at least here in Denmark now we are slowly opening up the society. The idea is if we have sufficient testing strategy, we can keep taking people out of the equation when they are infected, and we can trace down the chain of infection, so find families, relatives, colleagues that may be infected and take them out of the equation. Because now you will be in a scenario where you have a limited number that is infected, thus also a limited number that will go to the hospital. But on the other hand, you may have 60, 70, 80% of the economy and the society up and running. And the longer we can keep that period, the more time we will buy to find drugs that can treat severely ill people. We are already working intensely on that. Finding drugs that you potentially could get on prescription, so you may not even get to be severely ill. You take the pills at home for a couple of days, and that's it. And the ultimate goal is, of course, to find a vaccine so we can vaccinate all those people that are at risk. That will be sort of the first wave of vaccination. And then it will be up to the politicians, stakeholders, those that pay for it, whether the whole population should be vaccinated. And there, I would assume, at least in Denmark, we will go for the scenario where we vaccinate the vulnerable people, just like we do with our flu vaccines, because we anticipate that a very limited number outside of these groups are in risk and will become severely ill. That will be the most cost-efficient way of doing it. Worst case scenario is, of course, if we have a extended period now into the fall and winter where we don't fight off the pandemic completely, and potentially we get a second wave where more people become infected, that we will have to close down a little bit in the society again to sort of keep the expansion of infected people at bay. And that's not necessarily to say that we will close down the entire economy and have a lockdown like we've had now. One of the tools could be that we take all the schools, all the kids out of school again, because they comprise at least 10% of the population. So that will be a lot of people that you can take out and still keeping the production and economy going. The second tool could be that we limited workforce to half the normal staff or two whole shift or things like that. So you could limit the people that were in close contact and in that way bring the number of infected back to a manageable level.
You already mentioned a second wave, and many experts worry about a second wave similar to during the Spanish flu. 100 years ago, the second wave was more devastating than the first. Do we need to make fundamental changes to our way of living and working to prevent a second wave?
Well, the reason we are worried about a second wave is because we have a 100-year-old experience where 10 times more people died in the second wave than the first wave. So we gotta think in that this potentially could happen again. But one of the things that are different in current society is that we have a much better understanding of what is going on, and we have a much better sets of tools that can prevent that we will get a severe second wave. One of the dark horses is that these viruses, they mutate, and they mutate fast, and we never can predict what is the outcome of some of these mutations. It could be that the new virus is more lethal. It could also be that it becomes a mild flu infection. We simply don't know that. So with that in mind, we sort of got to prepare us for that it could happen. But as I talked a little bit about before, the strategy that we have in Denmark with intense testing, limit the number of infected people. Our State Serum Institute has been out recently saying that they don't anticipate a second severe wave. Not saying that there couldn't be a second wave, but it will be somewhat limited because we have all these measurements to keep the disease at bay.
What is the probability of a vaccine already this year? Also, what is the risk of speeding up the approval process?
The probability of vaccine, I think, is fairly good. It is always an issue to produce vaccine. Approximately 10% of those medicine and vaccines and so on that ends up in clinical testing will eventually end up being a product, because there is a lot of cases where you very long down in the pipeline realize this is not going to work for sufficient number of people. There are too many side effects and so on. So you will have to stop the development. But there are several groups, both here in Copenhagen and Oxford, among others, that I can see are very far, and they have very promising products. So I will be surprised if we don't manage to make a vaccine here. It will take a year and a half at least, before we can hope for the first product to emerge. And that is simply because there is a long testing phase. When you vaccinate your people in the testing phase, you need to wait long enough so you are sure they have been exposed to the disease, so you can see that the vaccine actually have an effect. And that takes quite a lot of time. It also takes time to set up a production unit, because it's not all vaccine factories that can produce all kinds of vaccine. It very much depends on what type, what platform the vaccine is made on. The legislation in terms of speeding up the approval, that will be a cost-benefit analysis, because you accept a little bit more side effects if the disease is severe enough. So, for instance, the Ebola, there was very little testing before you start vaccinating people, because anyway, 50% would die. This is not the case with corona, so I doubt that our legislation will speed it up too much and run the risk of too many side effects, because after all, it's a limited number that gets severely ill and die from this disease. But I can see that Oxford, for instance, have made a couple of steps where they sort of have speeded up the production. One of them is they were fortunate. They had already produced a vaccine towards the previous SARS. So all they had to do was to exchange part of the genetic material with the current SARS. And that means they have also had a product that they already had tested in animals and in humans. So they already had a lot of experience to lean upon. I also know that the volunteers they need for the first clinical testing, large-scale testing, they had recruited all those people. They are primarily students in the Oxford areas. They had already recruited them up front, because there is a long process of working out who is eligible for such a test and who are not. So they already had the list ready, sort of say, for people to enter clinical trial. And I also know, because they got a lot of money from the UK government, that they have set up or increased the production unit that they already have. And they essentially are starting out making the first step in the production, even though they know it could end in the garbage bag. But if it turns out to be efficient, then they have sort of circumvented the first step, and that will also speed up the process. So I think it is realistic that we, within a year, year and a half, will have the first product available, not in huge quantities, but at least it will be a start.
My last question is about face masks. They are seen by this website as essential in the restart process, at least in some parts of the economy. Why do the Danish health authorities not recommend the use of face masks? Several studies conclude that face masks protect other people against asymptomatic persons, not least when using public transport or in crowded shopping center. Are we, the Danes, really so much smarter than billions of Asians, or more precisely, the rest of the world?
Yeah, that is a very good question, because there has been a lot of debate about face masks. And One of the problems is that there is a cultural idea whether to use masks and not. Because if you travel in Asia, you will see that it's quite common. People use them both to protect themselves and the surroundings. So it's sort of seen as a courtesy to society. And that culture is not in Denmark. So currently, if people were start wearing masks, they will be outed because everyone would see them as infectious cases and stay away from us. So there will be a long way to go if you sort of have to tell everyone that it's actually a courtesy to the society and there is nothing wrong in wearing the mask. There's also the issue of getting enough supply, because that has been a problem in Denmark. And there we have prioritized that the mask went for the critical care people, the staff in hospitals, elderly home, and so on. So we could in that way help the most vulnerable people. The third thing is, there are many studies that shows that masks have an effect, but it is limited. And that is because the mask is not a tight seal around the mouth and the nose. So you will get some drops out on the side of these masks. The other thing is, it's very important that people know how to use them, not having them sitting under their chin, as you see some people. That's not the way to do it, but also because the mask, when they get moist, and they will do that fairly quickly, then they are not working, because now the virus can penetrate the mask in the fluid, and then you need to change them. So you will have to teach people, spend several of them during the day. The more intense labor you have, the more frequent you have to change these masks. In terms of getting infected, there is also the issue that the virus can get into the body, not only through the mouth and nose, but also, for instance, in the eye, that the first infection can start there and then spread to the rest of the body. So there is some limitation there in what the mask can prevent.
Thank you, Jan Prausgaard Christensen, for taking part in this podcast.
You're welcome.